RadioInfluence.com.
Welcome to the November 27th, 2019 edition of the MMA Report Podcast with Daniel Galvan. I am Jason Foy, and of course, this week's episode of the podcast is presented by Roman. Later on in the show, we're going to tell you about the tremendous offer that Roman has for the MMA Report Podcast listener. But coming up here on this week's edition of the show, we're going to kick things off by talking about Bellator London and the matchmaking of Michael Page and kind of the reaction that we have seen, in the media and also on social media since that fight took place. Also, got to briefly mention about why the hell did Ben Cartlidge think Fabian Edwards, Mike Shippen was a 30-27 fight. I think we can pretty much all agree it was 29-28. We'll get into that. Then we're going to debut a new segment here on the MMA Report Podcast where every week we're going to have a fight flashback. We're going to take a look at an older fight, whether it may be UFC, Bellator, Pride, WEC, something that happened around this time. And this week, we are going to go back to November the 15th of 2008. That was UFC 91. We're going to discuss Brock Lesnar versus Randy Couture when Brock Lesnar became the UFC heavyweight champion. So you'll hear that. Then we're going to get into the whole Khabib versus Ferguson, everything that's happened over the past couple days. Also relate that story to what Gina Carano told to Ariel Helwani earlier this week on his show. Plus, going to have two interviews for you. Two men that are going to be fighting at UFC DC coming up next week. Ricky Simon and Cody Stamann. Of course, Ricky going to be taking on Rob Font, while Cody is going to be taking on Yadong Song. So all that coming up on this week's edition of the MMA Report Podcast. Daniel, man, it's good to talk to you. It's Thanksgiving Eve. As we do this show, my wife went out this morning and got a little pumpkin pie, so I'm excited about that. Are you excited for the Thanksgiving holiday, or are you just like, hey, man, it's another day?
Hey, for me, unfortunately, it's another day, man, just because of my job. You know, I work on Thanksgiving Day in the news industry, and not only do I work the night shift, which means I have to cover Black Friday shopping, which is just, I have anxiety thinking about that. I mean, there's going to be so many hooligans out there just looking to mess up my live shot I do with my reporter. I'm so scared and concerned. But yeah, man, tomorrow, Thanksgiving, just when the food's about ready and my family's over, I'm going to be like, deuces, I got to go pick up McDonald's for lunch. So honestly, man, the Thanksgiving holiday is very special in my heart. I hope everyone listening and yourself has a sweet holiday, but unfortunately, I won't be able to celebrate it. But how about you, man? What do you got going on for the Thanksgiving festivities?
So it starts off about noon at my wife's parents' house, and then about 4 or 5 o'clock, we make the trek over to my parents' house, and then basically the days for us starts at about 11:45 when we get in the car to go to her parents' house, and then we usually get home about 7, 8 o'clock at night. It's a long day.
Yeah, it is always a long day, and it works well when you're hosting it at your own house, or if you're not driving, just because from my point of view, my favorite part about Thanksgiving now that I'm of age is drinking and watching football. Like, that to me is what I love about Thanksgiving, in addition to the delicious food and the family. But nothing like to me, nothing is better than just sitting with, you know, your bro cousin or your uncle, and just, you got some beer in your hand, watching some football, getting ready for Thanksgiving. And nothing's better than excusing yourself, like, as soon as you devour your plate, back to watch the football game. And it's funny because, you know, and I listened to the Bill Simmons podcast, and they kind of talked about this, but it's ironic because every Thanksgiving, like, you can't wait for that first football game, and it's always the Detroit Lions.
Yeah.
And it never lives up to your expectations. It's like the second quarter of the game's already boring because a lot of these years the Lions have not been very good. And, like, it's like, damn, I haven't really seen that many good first Thanksgiving football games. It's usually, especially because I live in Texas, man, it's that midday Cowboys game. Usually is what, you know, the family gets around the TV. So that is honestly what I'm going to miss the most, just drinking some beer, watching some football. And I also miss the Texas A&M game, especially when they would play the University of Texas on Thanksgiving. Oh my gosh, those were amazing. You know, so in all across the country, I think if you're a sports fan, the football and the beer and the food is the combination that I love.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those days of the year. Actually, you kind of get to watch a lot of football. Just because last time we played on Thanksgiving Day once in Dallas, man,
that must have sucked.
Had to be like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
10, 12 years ago. But yeah, it's like it's funny. Like people ask me, they'll ask me, oh, what's going on with, you know, the Los Angeles Rams? I'm like, I don't know. Like just because I do an NFL team broadcast, I only pay attention to about four teams.
Yeah, exactly. You got to know, you know, about your division realistically. And dude, you are so in the moment. I mean, look, I work at the NBA G League, and I could not tell you much about teams in the Eastern Conference. I do the Rio Grande Valley Vipers in the West Conference. And yeah, I don't know who. I can't even name you some of the Eastern Conference teams because you are so in the moment while everyone else is flipping channels and on Twitter. We are paying insane attention to the game to make sure to troubleshoot issues or to make directing calls. And yeah, you are just in your own little tunnel vision. And sometimes when you work in sports, sometimes you kind of want to take a break from consuming that particular sport every once in a while. You might want to watch a movie or a TV show rather than what you just got paid to do, as much as you may love that thing.
Oh, it's like I got home on Sunday from Atlanta. I was like, oh, man, I'm going to watch Packers 49ers. But then that bed just looked so comfortable.
That game was a blowout, too. So that made you – that was a whole little NyQuil treat, yeah.
But I will tell you, so did not watch Bellator London live. Actually, I saw the second round of Edwards and Shipman because we were in the bus headed – or actually, I was in an Uber going out to get dinner. And so I saw the second round. But outside of that, I saw all this stuff, you know, after the fact. And of course, then I see, you know, there's an article about on MMA Junkie talking about, you know, the matchmaking of Michael Page. And it's almost like, and I heard, you know, Big John and Josh Thompson on their podcast talking about it. I'm sitting there going, the criticism of Michael Page's matchmaking in Bellator is not like a new story. Like, and I kind of felt like people were making it out to be a new story. Now, look, I give Bellator a pass on last Saturday's matchup. And the reason I give them a pass is the fact of they had booked Michael Page against Derek Anderson. And then 7-10 days before the fight, Derek Anderson pulls out due to an injury. At that point, when you're talking about an overseas event, you're going to be limited on who could potentially step up to take the fight. And the other aspect is I don't know how many people want to step up on 1 week's notice to fight Michael Page for this reason. Michael Page has a completely unique skill set to where you necessarily just can't get ready in 7 days to fight that skill set. You want to have a 6 to 8 week camp. I think if you want to make a correlation to a fighter in the UFC, I think it's like if you're going to fight Stephen Thompson, you don't want to fight Stephen Thompson on 1 week's notice because it's not exactly like you'd likely have someone in your gym who can mimic Stephen Thompson accurately. So I give Bellator a pass on this one just for that reason. But let's also, like, we're talking about he's coming off a fight where he just beat a guy who was 3-1. Like, I understand the slow build, but when you go from fighting Paul Daly, which was a god-awful fight, and then getting starched by Douglas Lima, and now you're fighting a guy who's got 4 professional fights, the media has to understand why fans are complaining about this. The fact is fans are tired. They are tired of seeing what is viewed as nothing but showcase fights for Michael Page.
And the worst part for the media, for the fans, really, I mean, for the promotion, isn't the fans that are complaining. At least they're still watching. The worst part is when you put on these fights, it's the fans that don't care, the fans that aren't tuning in. And that's the real cost of doing showcase fights for notable fighters. At the end of the day, this Bellator London show did not resonate on a weekend where it was the only thing going on in the mixed martial arts world. This fight card was an opportunity to put on something special in Europe where Bellator would have been the sole discussion, but it really wasn't. And that is the real cost of doing showcase fights with Michael Page, because it's not the people complaining, it's the people who don't care. Because at the end of the day, if your fight happens in a forest, you're not making too much money on your ad sales. And for Michael Page, the thing is, I get why somebody wouldn't want to take his fight on short notice. And you bring up a good point. This isn't the fight to make this case, in my opinion, because this was a one-week replacement. And the original fight was pretty good between Michael Page and Derek Anderson. So the intention was to put together a solid welterweight contest for sure. But it's hard to expect someone to come in on 1 week. I mean, you look at how Michael Page fought here against Gianni Melillo. And, man, Page is one hell of a talent, independent of whoever his opponent is. What I really appreciate about his fight style is how it seems like there's, like, 2 miles of distance between himself and his opponent. There's so much space. You think, there's no way he's going to hit me in the next half second. But he's so fast with his lunge and how long he is that even though it appears as though there's this illusion that the space between these two fighters is too much to expect contact, boom, he makes contact. He creates the space. Boom, he makes contact. And then, boom, he knocks you out. And that's the thing Paige, to me, does so well, is he tricks his opponent into thinking that they're kind of safe at that particular moment. And like a snake lunging at you with his bite, boom, he hits you, knocks you down. So that's incredibly hard to prepare for. And Michael Page, currently his identity as a fighter is, you put him in a mismatch, he's going to look like a highlight reel fighter. Who isn't? But you put him against a tough welterweight in Bellator, and it's going to be kind of like, the illusion fades and you kind of see the real deal.
Look, I understand that Michael Page wants that rematch against Douglas Lima, but as I tweeted the other day, I said, I think we can all understand why Michael Page wants a rematch, but the reality is he needs to fight top welterweight competition before this should be even considered it. And two comments I got on it was, from at DirtyBird212, he says, we've seen less dominant fighters lose one and get an immediate rematch. Daly is 2-0 post Lima and was winning that fight. Give him the shot. Then at Guz Congo goes Lorenz Larkin, Andre Koreshkov, or Paul Daly should be next for Michael Page. And I completely agree with what Brandon Guzman said there. Is, I mean, look, for Michael Page, he has got to beat elite competition. But Daly, I want to go down the matchmaking of Michael Page in Bellator. Let's take out the 2 welterweight tournament fights. Tell me who you think is the best fighter. So his first fight in Bellator was against Ryan Sanders, who now fights in New England Fights up there. Then you've got Ricky Rainey at Bellator 120. Then it was at Bellator 128, Noshan Burrell. Bellator 140, Rudy Bears. Bellator 144, Charlie Ontiveros. Bellator 153, Jeremy Holloway. Bellator 158, Santos, Evelina Santos, Cyborg Santos. Bellator 165, Fernando Gonzalez. Bellator 200, David Rickles. Bellator 227, Richard Keeley, and now Bellator London 2, Giovanni Melillo. Who's the best fighter?
Paul Daly. And then
outside of Paul Daly and David Douglas Rickles. Lima.
It's David Rickles.
But the guy who's given him the hardest fight is Fernando Gonzalez.
Oh, yeah. Fernando Gonzalez. But the problem with Fernando is, like, after that fight, he's really dropped off. But Fernando did, and then also the other fight was his very first fight was like super impressive, because at that time when he fought Ricky Rainey, I thought Ricky Rainey and Page were just two of the hotter prospects in the sport. But man, it kind of after that Page loss, Gonzalez went and reeled off 2 good wins over Gertz and Ward, and then after that you see him lose 4 or 5. So I guess you're right, Fernando is probably it.
But I think the thing is, if you are someone who wants to come to Bellator's defense, the thought is, though, when you look at outside of the welterweight tournament fights, he hasn't fought the current top competition in the Bellator welterweight division. I mean, look, as a media member, if the criticism Michael Page matchmaking just came across your headline, you have seriously not been paying attention, because this criticism has been out there for a long time. And as I said, I'm not criticizing the matchmaking for this past week. And because of the opponent change, I wouldn't mind if Bellator said, you know what, let's run it back, Derek Anderson, when you're healthy. Let's run you back against Michael Page. I have no problem. But if it's not Derek Anderson, it should be someone like a Lorenz Larkin, like an Andre Koreshkov. And the other thing, look, you know, you can mention Logan Storley. I don't think there's a chance in hell Bellator puts Michael Page up against a wrestler.
Yeah, 0% chance of that fight happening. It's as simple as Logan's going to put him on his back and he's going to ruin some steam on Michael Page. So, look, it's this was a problem, or let's not even say a problem. This was an identity of Bellator before Scott Coker even took over. Before Scott Coker took over, we still saw some particular fighter and prospects get fed tomato can and tomato can and tomato can. So that's happened to some fighters. Now, Scott Coker, he's continued that trend. And the reason why I hesitate to say it's a problem is because when you look at Strikeforce, showcase fights do make stars, especially if you continue to put the spotlight on them and they put together highlight reel wins. Stuff like that makes you interested in a Brett Rogers fight. And that's what happened in Strikeforce. We were down for a Brett Rogers fight because he looks pretty damn good. So the strategy itself can work. The issue is the card Bellator London, for instance, is if all you have are showcase fights or fights that don't have a notable fighter in them, no one cares. And so, unfortunately, in this case, Michael Page, I think Michael Page has already been built up, though, and that's what makes him different, is he's already been built up. We know what he is. We've gone through the hype machine and we've gone through his steady diet of tomato cans. And from this point forward, I don't know how much more you can build on him with these showcase contests that to me is just all about putting him in compelling fights time after time after time, because now you can kind of reap the benefits of all the time you've invested in Michael Page. Now it's time to put him in these fights. He can have a loss and still maintain his name value. And you know, Michael Page versus Derek Anderson wouldn't have rocked the MMA world, but Michael Page versus a similarly good fighter could have, with more of a name value that kind of pops, could have been the big talking point in the MMA world this past weekend.
If you had told me it was Michael Page, Derek Anderson, it gets me more motivated to tune on that Bellator app to watch Michael Page fight. With the fight that it was, I had zero interest because I knew what it was. I will say this, you know, to me, the ultimate criticism towards Bellator and Michael Page matchmaking is you go to the Richard Keeley fight. Like that fight should never be made. Just because two guys have a beef on social media doesn't necessarily mean you automatically make a fight.
Yeah, just do it if they're YouTube stars, all right, maybe, because you might make some money off it. But that one, no, you would not have. And that was the one where, yeah, let's talk about it. But yeah, we knew exactly what was going to happen. And look, it's kind of dangerous at times. I mean, you don't want to put – Michael Page is a dangerous SOB. He will put you in a real, real bad place, especially if you aren't on his level. And man, he knocked out Melillo so bad, like – dude, he did the full snow angel when he went down to the ground, and it was a brutal way and to end the night. And at least the fans in attendance got a highlight reel finish.
Look, man, this is the thing I would say. You use the Nate Diaz line, not surprised. Like we knew that was going to happen. And that's the unfortunate part. And hopefully whoever they put against Michael Page next is a fight that wants you to tune in wherever that fight is being broadcast as. The other thing about this fight card that sticks out to me, you know, we talked about it last week on the podcast. The reason to watch Bellator London was the co-main event of Fabian Edwards and Mike Shipman. It was a, you know, kind of this test for Fabian Edwards of is he ready to take that next step in his career? And, it's a close fight. I don't think anyone would argue second round is clearly a Mike Shipman round. third round is clearly a Fabian Edwards round. It comes down to the first round, and look, you can go either way on that. But the fact that Ben Carkridge scored that fight 30-27 just kind of makes me go, what was he watching? Because I don't know how you score the second round for Fabian Edwards. I have no problem if you get Fabian Edwards a first round or Mike Schmidt the first round. But to me, I don't see how you can score the fight 3-0 for Fabian Edwards.
Yeah, round two was clearly Shipman's round. And I actually had this fight 29-28 for Michael Shipman. And I thought this was a rough fight for Fabian Edwards just because coming into it, my expectation was for him to win this one. And he did win it. But round one, he was way too cautious in my opinion. And that cautiousness is kind of why I scored the fight for Shipman, who was doing more to control Edwards. And while Edwards did have a solid moment in round two, that was Shipman's round. And then round three, he turned it on. And it's like, damn, I wish Fabian Edwards would have fought like that around two and one, because to me, I came into this fight thinking he was a bit more talented, even though Shipman is pretty damn good. And this was one heck of a matchup. The 30-27 scorecard is absolutely perplexing. Again, my scorecard was 29-28, Michael Shipman. I thought he won rounds one and rounds two. It was a solid win for Fabian Edwards. He called out Costello Van Steenis.
Give me that fight. I'm telling you. You tell me that is an action packed fight. I just think you're going to see two guys that are like, screw this going to the ground thing, that they are just going to try to fling some bombs. That is a fight I want to see.
Yeah. And it's going to be a great fight, especially to do it in Europe. I mean, both these guys have so much pride. And it's all about who's the best middleweight in the continent of Europe. And I think Steenis and Edwards is good. And then for Michael Shipman, man, this was a really good performance. We know Fabian Edwards is a true talent, and to fight him close like this, I mean, he's moving upwards, even though he got a loss on his record.
Look, if Bellator wanted to do a big event, let's say like in, March in London, I mean, I know they're going to, I think it's Dublin in February with the James Gallagher fight. Tell me, this would be a big card for them. Michael Page versus Paul Daly, Fabian Edwards versus Costello Van Steenis.
I think that'd be great. I mean, you look at the atmosphere they had for this card. Dude, this crowd was nice. This crowd was awesome. And it was a lame duck card. You put on those two fights in Europe, I think you'll get yourself one heck of a venue, one heck of an environment. And that sounds like a solid show to me.
Yeah, look, if they're going to go down the Page Daily route again, I mean, and obviously I was there for the first one. It absolutely sucked. But if they're going to go down that route, that fight's got to be in London. It's got to be.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Reward these fans who continue to go to your shows, even though you let them down with the type of cards you're giving them.
I will say this, and kind of circling back to Michael Page, the way Bellator has match made Michael Page throughout his run in Bellator is very similar to what they're doing for James Gallagher, where they're putting him in against opponents that have solid records, but clearly it's fights you expect James Gallagher to win. And I've said this, I can't tell you how many managers I talk to that sit there and say, I've got plenty of bantamweights that would love to fight James Gallagher.
Mm-hmm. They want to get that win. And
I'm telling you, there's a lot of fighters, especially here in the States, that believe James Gallagher is an easy fight.
Yeah, I'm sure. And the thing is, it's something they're not going to make, because they don't want to, they don't want him to get that loss, another loss like that. And I think if it comes out that the blueprint for Bellator in Europe was leaked, I don't think we would be surprised to see that their blueprint in Europe is, let's get a talented fighter and just have him fight a bunch of guys under his class and get those showcase wins, because that is the formula and that is the product they are delivering. They're like, let's do a main event with an A side and a D side and then nothing else.
But here's the thing, and you got to give Bellator a lot of kudos on this. The fact is, if they've gone into that market and they've been able to acquire talent, I mean, you're able to acquire someone like a Fabian Edwards that could be a star for them. That is the one thing that, when Bellator goes to these international markets, that's what it's about. It's about acquiring that talent that they can get before they get to the UFC, before the UFC is willing to put a financial offer on the table to acquire a talent. So you got to give Bellator kudos for that. Of course, Bellator's next event.
But I want to mention one thing real quick.
Okay, go ahead.
The prelims had a couple of interesting notes, I thought. the biggest one was Robert Whiteford at the featherweight division. Mm-hmm. He retired, Jason, and he came back, and with like 6 seconds left in the fight, he knocked out Sam Cecilia. So I just wanted to note that performance because I felt like that was, you know, a big deal. In addition to that, you had Denise Kielholz get like a quick 30-second Americana win, and then the other main card fight we didn't talk about, which wasn't that notable, the lightweight fight, Soren Bach just went out there and out-grappled Terry Brazier. But I just wanted to mention Robert Whiteford because I do feel like if he continues to fight in Bellator, he's actually a pretty solid talent in this featherweight division.
Yeah, it's look, I mean, Bellator, you know, they don't do a ton of events. You know, they're not like some other promotions that, you know, put on 25, 30, you know, 35 events a year. They're going to do about 22 to 25 events a year. But, to, you know, they're doing good things. And I think you have to give Scott Coker a lot of credit for that. Now, you know, I mentioned that we wanted to start a new segment here. Kudos. Daniel is the one who came up with this idea. So all credit goes to Daniel on this one where, you know, every week we're going to look back at a older MMA fight. And, you know, and what we want to do is try to find fights that happened around this general time. Now, Thanksgiving week is pretty much a week that essentially no promoters want to do shows just because, you know, you're going to struggle at the ticket gate. So, you know, started looking at events that happened in March, and we ended up going with UFC 91, which was on November the 15th of 2008, 11 years ago. And it was headlined by Randy Couture defending the UFC heavyweight title against Brock Lesnar. You know, I think one of my general thoughts as I went back and watched this fight on UFC Fight Pass was, you know, in today's UFC, I think, Daniel, there's a very slim chance a fighter is going to get a UFC title fight in their fourth professional fight. And that's what happened here with Brock Lesnar. And I just think it's, I mean, literally maybe a 1% chance that happens in today's UFC.
Yeah. Yeah. It likely will not happen unless we're talking about like a similar situation. And what I mean by similar situation is a mega, mega super duper star that three fights into their career showcase they have what it takes. Like, we're talking like if Tyson Fury comes in to the UFC and in his first fight beats like the 15th ranked heavyweight, and then the second fight he comes in and beats the 10th ranked guy, then all right, maybe he'll get a title shot. But that's like never going to happen. So, yeah, not only was it his fourth professional fight, Brock Lesnar was 1-1 in the UFC prior to this one. I mean, he came in with a loss to Frank Mir, and then he destroyed Heath Herring, and then 2-1. It's just such a, you know, there's a lot of things rewatching UFC 91 that stick out to you. You know, the banners behind each fighter.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. You know, all the ads. I was looking for Condom Depot, but we couldn't find it. And, you know, it just felt old, which is such a weird thing because in this fight, you know, I'm glad we picked this fight. This is a fight very, very, very important to me because – and you were the one who suggested this fight. It's ironic, but UFC 91 is the very first UFC pay-per-view I ever watched live. It's the first pay-per-view that I saw advertisement for, and I – decided to purchase it with my dad's credit card, obviously, but you know, and that speaks to why Brock Lesnar got this fight, even though, cause I grew up as a wrestling fan, but when I watched wrestling, it was already after Brock Lesnar had wrestled. So it's not even like I knew who Brock Lesnar was, but watching the commercials and consuming the hype, Brock Lesnar's star power made me compelled to buy this pay-per-view. Just watching the product of like the UFC countdown and the commercials. That's why he got this title fight. He got people like me to buy the pay-per-view. This pay-per-view did a little over a million buys, and that's why he got this fight. And man, the fight itself, I remember watching it live. The fight itself was one hell of a fight, man. It really was.
Yeah, you know, it's going back and for talking about fight, I want to say the first pay-per-view that I went out and watched live, I want to say was UFC 66, which was Liddell versus Ortiz.
So that was like, that was one where you saw the hype around it. Yeah, because so that was a big time fight. Like, how did, what made you convert to the UFC, basically?
Well, basically, it was, I mean, like, I had seen The Ultimate Fighter, and it was, you know, I had some buddies who would always go out, and they said, hey, man, why don't you come out tonight for, you know, it's a big fight. And that was kind of really, like, kind of what really started me really becoming a combat sports fan. And a lot of it was just simply hanging out with the fellas that you may not hang out with all the time. And so that's the first pay-per-view that I can remember watching live. But I remember, man, being, you know, a young kid, my brother going to Blockbuster Video. Do you even know what Blockbuster Video is, by the way?
I do.
Okay.
I'm not a four-year-old. Yeah, man, I grew up watching my Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And
I remember him bringing home the VHS for UFC 1, and we watched it. You know, but I want to say that was the first pay-per-view that I ever watched live. And of course, I've watched many pay-per-views, you know, since then. But, you know, going back and watch this fight, you know, and, you know, when I suggest this fight to you, one of the things that kind of I didn't remember how competitive Randy was in the fight. When I went back and watched it, I was like, man, Randy was pretty competitive in this fight. You know, and you look in that opening round, you know, I thought Couture, you know, he gets off to a good start with, you know, taking this fight against a fence, grappling, and, you know, because it was such a huge size difference. I mean, you know, on fight night, Brock probably had 40 pounds on him.
Oh, he had more, according, because, like, the thing is, when you look at the tail of the tape, Randy Couture, 220. Lesnar, 265, which was the limit.
He was probably like 285.
Dude, that's it looked like a middleweight versus a heavyweight.
Yeah, yeah, during the broadcast, even Joe Rogan had mentioned, he's like, these guys look like they're three weight classes apart. But, you know, Randy did a really good job, even with the size difference. You know, Lesnar scored, you know, got a takedown, but, you know, Couture was able to work his way. He tried to get on the back, which if he got on the back of Brock in the opening round, who knows, maybe is able to get it. You know, Lesnar, you know, landed some good punches in top position. You know, the final, you know, 40 seconds, you know, left in the opening round. You know, Lesnar's back is against the fence, but Couture unable to get the fight to the ground. And I want to say it was about 20 seconds left in the opening round. Mario Yamasaki was a referee for the fight, did warn Brock about, you know, grabbing the fence. But then, you know, one of the, you know, because obviously when Brock came into MMA, he was, I think for the most part, MMA fans just, they wanted to see this guy lose. They didn't want to see someone who had, you know, for the most part, made a name for himself being a WWE wrestler, even though he was a tremendous, you know, college wrestler at the University of Minnesota. And in between the rounds, it was a loud cheer for Randy Couture and obviously a lot of boos there, you know, for Brock Lesnar. You know, but Brock, you know, I think when you talk about like peak of MMA, you know, in that 2006 to 2009 range, I mean, Brock Lesnar is really the key to all of it.
He was the show, man. He was the show. He brought the show, and it felt like a big event. Everything he did was special. The fight starts, and the crowd is so invested to it. They're invested in the wrestling between these two. It's back and forth. As the advantages switch, you can hear the crowd, man. They are so in this fight. Stand-up was back and forth. Lesnar got cut in this fight, and this fight ended after Lesnar kind of threw a punch, and it connected almost like in the back of Couture's head, and his light just went out. And then after that, it was just side control with the masturbation punches from Brock Lesnar. That was my memory of Lesnar versus Couture, was side control, ground and pound, fight over. And I kind of forgot about how close it was, as you mentioned.
Well, you remember? Go ahead.
What's that?
Go ahead.
All right. I was just going to say my general thought was Brock Lesnar is one hell of an athlete because he's huge. But the thing, a lot of these fights, like Couture was on top or whatever, or he had a nice little position. And Lesnar utilizes athleticism to slip out and put Couture in a disadvantageous position. So that was my other point, was like, not only was there a big size difference, but like Lesnar was so many light years ahead of Randy Couture as a pure athlete.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, at that time of this fight, Brock was 31 years old, and we can talk about kind of, you know, Brock and kind of where everything went from there. But you know, right before kind of the ending sequence, Randy had actually cut Brock underneath his right eye. There's a moment where you see, you know, Brock's, you know, wiping away the blood from right underneath his eye. but it was a right hand that ultimately dropped Randy Couture, and then just those hammer fists from hell that Brock Lesnar brought on. And you know, one of the things about it is because it was a title fight, you know, Mario let it go on for a while. You could have made the case where Mario could have easily stopped that fight. I mean, God knows how many, you know, it had to be 20, 25 punches that Brock threw on the ground, just a short hammer fist. And after the fight was over, Randy Couture said, he goes, "That's a big son of a bitch." And it's hard to avoid those big ham hawks that are coming your way. But, you know, I mean, the thing about Brock, like, you watch that fight and you mentioned about, you see the athleticism, and it the one thing that we're always going to wonder about Brock is, what if he never had the medical issues? What would he have been?
I think he would have been the champion until he wasn't, because I think he would have been the champion until a man by the name of Cain Velasquez came around, because that was my last takeaway. My last takeaway was, if Brock Lesnar came around three years later, that's when the game changed in the heavyweight division. Mm-hmm. That's when I felt like the skill level jumped majorly, because this fight was very sloppy when you contrast it with how Cain Velasquez fights, with how Stipe fights, with how Junior Dos Santos fights, with how Daniel Cormier fights. There's been a big evolution in how heavyweights fight. Heavyweights today fight so much smoother and more technically sound, and there aren't a lot of big holes in their game. And that was my takeaway, was Lesnar came around in the perfect time when he could compete against guys like Frank Mir and Shane Carwin. Guys who, look, Shane Carwin has a gas tank for 2 minutes. And then Frank Mir has some pretty big holes in his game as well. So this was a perfect time. But when you contrast the heavyweights in 2008 with the heavyweights in 2019, the gap is tremendous. And I know that's the case in every weight class. But in the heavyweight division especially, this was the perfect time, in my opinion. Even if Brock Lesnar was healthy, I think from a skill set standpoint, I feel as though Brock Lesnar would not have been a heavyweight champion in 2010. And so that's just my general thought. And then the other thought I had was, which UFC champion in 2008 in their 2008 form would be able to beat their 2019 counterpart? And to me, I think it might just, the only one might be GSP or Anderson Silva. I think those two guys might be able to defend their title against Usman and Adesanya. Probably not Anderson, but otherwise, every other modern version will take out the 2008 version.
Yeah, Anderson was the name that immediately popped my mind. Prime GSP against a Kamaru Usman. That would be an interesting one. I don't know if I would automatically pick GSP.
Yeah, I mean, well, you shouldn't. It's been 10 years. Think about the other fights. John Jones versus Rashad Evans and Khabib versus BJ Penn. You should not be picking the guy who fought in 2009. So the fact that we're even considering it speaks to how damn good these two guys were.
Yeah, I'm just pulling up all the UFC champion history. So 2008... Let's see, you would have had, Force Griffin won the light heavyweight title in 2008. Clearly, you'd pick John Jones.
Yeah, yeah. It's Forrest and Rashad were the two champs in the 205-pound division.
Middleweight, welterweight, your lightweight champion, as I kind of scrolled down here, in 2008.
It was BJ Penn.
Was it BJ?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it was BJ.
Yeah. He was scary at the time, but, you know, no, I don't. Nurmagomedov would destroy him.
Yeah, no. I mean, in 2008, you didn't have a UFC featherweight champion, so that didn't happen until 2010. But
yeah, probably Uriah Faber in WEC. It was probably him or Aldo. I don't know when. Yeah. I can't remember when Aldo won the title. Yeah, and then it might have been Miguel Torres in the bantamweight division.
Boy, a 2008 version of Anderson versus Israel Adesanya right now, that would be a fight that you'd love to see.
All right, here are the champions in WEC. It's basically Uriah Faber to close out the year, and then Mike Brown, And then in Bantamweight division, it's Miguel Torres. So
yeah, yeah, you're picking right.
I don't think Miguel Torres is going to win that fight.
Yeah, yeah, definitely your pick is GSP in that one. But yeah, if there's a fight you want to hear us, you know, go back and watch, you know, let us know. I'll be looking into the first week of December here of what fight we're going to talk about next week. But if you ever have a suggestion, you know, definitely hit us up on that. Of course, before we get into talking about Khabib and Tony Ferguson, do want to tell you about our presenting sponsor this week, and that is Roman. And guys, talking about erectile dysfunction isn't easy. Usually we just brush it off or blame ourselves and saying things like I lost my mojo, or avoid it altogether with excuses like I had a long day at work, or sorry honey, I'm just not feeling it. But with Roman, it's easy to talk about it with a real doctor who can prescribe real medication. It's simple, safe, and totally discreet.
And Jason, with Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. The doctor will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, Roman will ship it to you with, get this, free 2-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward, simple, and discreet. And getting started is simple. You just got to go to GetRoman.com/MMAReport. You just got to go to GetRoman.com/MMAReport and complete an online visit. Erectile dysfunction used to be tough to tackle, but now there's Roman. Complete an online visit today to connect with the doctor and take care of it.
And all you got to do, just like Daniel said, is go to GetRoman.com/MMAReport to get a free online visit and free 2-day shipping. That's GetRoman.com/MMAReport for a free visit to get started. GetRoman.com/MMAReport. And you know what? If you forget that that unique URL, it's right here in the notes, whether you're, you know, listening to this on radioinfluence.com, themareport.com, or even on the podcasting app, just go into the notes description and that link is right there. I do appreciate Roman's support here of the MMA Report podcast, and love all our listeners showing their support by checking out Roman and going to that unique URL, GetRoman.com/MMAReport. But Daniel, was the other day, Brett Okamoto had a tweet that was basically, it was essentially saying, look, the UFC wants to do Tony Ferguson, Khabib Nurmagomedov, April 18th in Brooklyn. And Ali Abdelaziz, Khabib Nurmagomedov's manager, ends up putting out a bout agreement that Khabib is signing it. And in the story, Brett Okamoto had mentioned about there's still future negotiations to go on, and which was basically this. Tony Ferguson hasn't agreed yet. They haven't come financial terms, and the UFC is trying to force them to get the terms that they want. And we had this this tweet from a listener. It was kind of a question, but more of a comment. This was from at JG10230. He goes, the Ariel Helwani tweet about signed contracts being posted on social media pressure and lowball another fighter. I don't really so much have a specific question, if I can say that right, better than just a general interest in discussion about a tactic when negotiating a fight. This is a tactic the UFC has used for a long time to force one side of they've got one side of the fight done, ready to go for the fight, and where they're basically using the media, in this case, Dana White going to Brett Okamoto, to pressure Tony Ferguson into taking the financial offer that the UFC is putting their way. This is nothing new from the UFC. They do this all the time. I can't tell you how many times I've heard a situation where the UFC will leak a fight out there and one of the fighters has not even accepted a fight. And it's the UFC's way of pressuring a fight. As I said earlier, use the Nate Diaz line, not surprised.
Not surprised at all. And yeah, it's crazy because I needed to double check this, but if you go to 2018 and you go to ESPN.com and you watch this interview that Brett Okamoto does with Dana White, Dana White says, when asked if he will do Ferguson versus Nurmagomedov again, Dana White says, hell no, I'm never making that fight ever again, ever. So, yeah. Dana White using ESPN to say stuff that doesn't really mean. Yeah, what a shocker. Yes, this fight's being made again. Jesus, why you taking money away from a fighter announcing a fight before he He accepts it. It's not official. If two guys don't sign the deal, that fight's not official, Jason. If I sign a deal, Jason, to meet you in a steel cage, but you don't sign it, we can't promote that fight. We can't say that fight's not official because it's not. And you're just putting pressure on the guy who hasn't signed it. Bro, why don't you sign it, bro? Bro, come on, bro. You got to take the fight. Dude, he's got to get as much money as he can because Tony Ferguson's been working his entire damn life for this moment. And you're going to try and lowball him on that? Try and pressure him? No, I hope Tony has smart people around his corner and around him. And I'm not super sure if that's the case just because, like, I'm aware of his rehabilitation process for his injuries, and that wasn't the greatest idea in the world. But I hope to God he has people around him that really take care of him, make sure he doesn't get pressured into signing a deal that leaves money on the table.
Yeah, he's rep by the Balanji Group, who has, they've really upped their MMA stable of fighters here over last year. And look, it's one of these things where, you know, clearly Tony and his management team, they've got a number. And that's the number they feel they should be paid to headline a card and fight for the UFC lightweight title against Khabib Nurmagomedov, which, you know, I think for a lot of people may be the fight that intrigues us the most going into 2020, the fight that we want to see. And then, you know, the UFC obviously has their number. And by putting this out there, to me, this is nothing more than the UFC trying to force Tony to take the deal that they're offering. And, you know, look, I hope Brett Okamoto realizes what, you know, Dana White's using him. That's what he's doing here. And to me, I almost feel like this is a very coordinated plan between Dana White in Ali Abdelaziz to get Tony Ferguson to take the financial offer that's being offered. But, you know, here's the crazy thing about Tony Ferguson. If this fight, say, takes place in April, you realize Tony Ferguson will be 36 years old.
That is insane. Here's the other thing I want to say. Let's not talk about this fight until April. Hype it up. Let's not think about it. Because every freaking time these two guys are scheduled to fight, something happens.
They got
to
be put in a bubble, man. They got to be put in a bubble, both of them.
Yep.
You can't train at all. All you can do is weight cut. All you can do is sit in a sauna.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm down. That's a great idea. If this fight does become official, if Tony Ferguson does sign it, we have to agree to take an oath of silence and not talk about this fight until
you can't get Saturday hyped. Morning. You can't get hyped till April the 18th.
Yeah.
At like 9:59 p.m. Eastern time.
Yeah. Dana White literally said he would never book this one again.
Look, when Dana White says he's not going to do something, we pretty much know what that means. But like, look, you see how this is being handled. And you can relate to what Gina Carano said on Aaron Helwani's show this week, where, you know, basically the synopsis of it is she goes, I had a meal with them. I sat down with them. They proposed this Ronda Rousey fight. They were going to pay me $1 million. And, you know, I was all in, but I told him, I said, the one thing I need is 6 months and I got to put a team together and please let's keep this private because I don't want this getting out there. And then of course what happens, Dana White magically goes to the media, like not surprised. This is how Dana White handles business, folks. This is how promoters handle business. And it's one of these things of when you hear Gina talk about that, if he was willing to do that to a fighter, they were going to pay $1 million to fight Ronda Rousey for a major pay-per-view. What do you think he's going to do a fighter who's on a introductory UFC contract starting off at $10,000?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing is, I think as a promoter, Dana White has probably burned some bridges. I think what I mean by that is, by constantly taking the same approach every time of like pressuring the fighter and taking the fight, he's lost some money because the thing is trust is important. And for a lot of people, if you make them feel like they can't trust you, they're not going to do business with you. And he's probably left money on the table because of his brash attitude, because he's had so much success, you know, strong arming people into doing what he wants that he's blinded by the fact of if he handles every situation like that, you're not going to get that Gina Carano Ronda Rousey fight because Gina Carano is going to say F you. There's plenty of time to promote that fight, but that wasn't the right process, and we never got that fight. And then, you know, to call her, you know, to the text that he allegedly sent her, a rough text to send her for sure.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is the thing. Like, look, I understand the goal for every fighter is to make it to the UFC and to become a UFC champion. I understand that. But, like, you sit there and, like, you hear what Gina Carano says. And, you know, you listen to other people, you know, of their interactions with the UFC. And why are you not sitting there and listening to Bellator? Because it's a rarity you hear anyone say anything bad about Scott Coker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's true, and it's like, the thing is, MMA fighters are some of the toughest people in the world, and you know what tough people don't want to feel like? They don't want to feel like they're being used. They don't want to feel disrespected. You do any of those things, I think they'll stand up for themselves.
Hey, and, look, I think a perfect example of that's Chris Cyborg. You know, say what you want, even though, like, every time I hear people say, she goes, oh, you know, Scott Coker won't do a co-promotion with UFC. Yeah, the UFC ain't doing no co-promotion with Bellator. Like, if you think that's possible, you literally are smoking some really good stuff.
Yeah, I don't know what. Yeah, that's a if that ever happens, I mean, that would
either that or you have some damn good gummies.
Yeah, or you really edited that video, you know, something like that.
Yeah, after the interview section, after we do the interviews, I'm actually going to bring up Chris Cyborg about a tweet she sent out this morning. So we'll talk about that later. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, like, I no one should be surprised at how the UFC is handling, you know, Tony Ferguson and look at the Gina Carano situation. And I think for all fighters, they should really be listening up and saying, you know what? You know, what's, you know, you have to sit there and say, what's the biggest priority? Is the biggest priority fighting for the UFC? Is the biggest priority about making the most money? Or is the biggest priority about fighting someone where you're going to be happy? And I think that's a big question mark. And we'll see. Look, I imagine at some point, I'm sure the Balanji Group and the UFC will sit down and they'll hammer out a deal. And we'll get this fight will get booked because clearly it's the fight that has to happen. But of course, the next UFC show is coming up next week. Of course, it'll be on ESPN in Washington, D.C. And you're going to hear two conversations that I've had over the past couple of days. Up first, you're going to hear my conversation with Ricky Simon as he's going to be taking on Rob Font. Also, you're going to hear my conversation with Cody Stamann, who's going to be taking on Yadong Song at UFC D.C.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report, a man's going to be part of the UFC Fight Night card in Washington, D.C., December the 7th. It's Ricky Simon. Ricky, appreciate time. You know, I was going back on an interview we did after your fight back in February, and you mentioned Rob Font was a name that interests you. You now got the fight. How did this one come together?
Well, I think, you know, we both agreed to the fight back then, actually, after I think you announced it. And then it never really came to fruition, I guess, because he had some fights that he took that ended up falling out. And then I got the favorite fight. So, you know, it's been a long time in the making now. So I'm excited that we're finally going to get in there and get it done.
Yeah, I'll never forget. After you told me that, I reached out to his manager, Tyson. I go, hey, Ricky's interested in Rob. And they're like, yeah, we like that fight too. You know, let's go. And obviously, Rob was supposed to fight earlier this year. That fight doesn't happen. Then the Lineker fight doesn't happen. It's been over a year since his last fight. And of course, you mentioned this is your first fight since the fight in July. Like, what do you take away from that fight?
I don't know. You know, that's how MMA goes. You know, I might have zigged when I should have zagged. I got caught, and that's about it. I've moved on from it. I'm excited to show that. You know, I definitely belong amongst the top bantamweights in the world, and I think I've proven that. And I'm excited to go in there and show it against the number 10 guy in the world.
I've talked to this about a lot of guys, and, you know, because I come from a football world, and we always talk about football being a game of inches. And I feel like you could say the exact same thing about fighting. You know, 1 inch on, you knock the guy out. 1 inch off, it's just a clean shot. I mean, is that kind of do you believe MMA is a game of inches?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Especially with those 4 ounce gloves, shots sneak through, and they, you know, You get friggin' hurt with those 4 ounce gloves too. So yeah, definitely getting the inches.
You know, we've talked about, you know, as you're getting ready to get married, you're now married, that the mullet may go away. You're still rocking the mullet. You know, the wife hasn't won that battle yet.
You know, she's still fighting. She's still, but she, I did trim. I took like around 4 inches off of it because it's getting a little too wild. And my last fight, I had to put it up because it was just too long. But we're just gonna trim it. That way, we can let it flow for the fights.
See, I'm just wondering because I think that the videos you and Tyson put out there are some of the most hilarious videos. Like, I'm just waiting. Am I gonna see Tyson post a video where he's cutting your hair as you're sleeping?
I have been like sleeping with one eye open last year and a half, 2 years, because, you know, I'm actually in Hawaii right now training with him. I stay at his house, and we mess with each other so much. I'm sure that he's going to get to that point where he's going to come up and try to snip some of it off.
I feel like he always tries to make sure you're in the back of his videos when he's promoting one of his sponsors.
Yeah. He uses me to promote a lot, but usually just, to make fun of me mostly, I think.
So how much of your camp will be in Hawaii as opposed to back in Oregon?
Well, I did the majority of already back with my team, American Top Team Portland. And then I came out here to get some rounds with Tyson and Martin Day and Ian Del Cuesta. And they got a bunch of guys out here my size with some really good boxing. So they're out here giving me a great look.
You know, when I think of Rob, I think of the striking aspect. Is there something else about his game that sticks out to you?
Mostly the striking aspect, I would say. And I mean, he has good jiu-jitsu too. I like the way he jumps on submissions. So he's a good overall fighter. That's why he's top 10 in the world. He's number 10 in the world right now. But I honestly feel like I match up great against him, and I'm excited to go put on a dominant performance against number 10.
Is there something about his game that fans just don't see, something little that really sticks out to you about, like you say, that's why he's a top 10 fighter?
There's plenty of it. I mean, there's so many killers. I feel like there's guys who are ranked 20, 25 right now who could be 10, you know, or 5, mm-hmm. You know, just the bantamweight division right now is so deep. So if you're in the UFC at this point, you're a savage. And I don't know. There's plenty that he does great, but I do it better.
I think heading into this fight, I think you would understand people are probably going to look at you as the underdog. What would you say to those fans?
I don't know. You're going to see. You're going to see on December 7th. You know, fans are forgetful. They're especially in the MMA community. They're forgetful. So December 7th, I'm going to remind them all.
Does that offer you any motivation at all when people are, you know, I don't know if doubting is the right word to say, but kind of maybe looking past you?
I don't give two shits. I don't care at all. I do the same thing every day. I bust my ass. I don't see any of these keyboard warriors putting any kind of work in anything like that. You know, my life is dedicated to this. I miss family events. I miss a bunch of stuff. I come out here to Hawaii, even though as great as that sounds, you know, I'm a recluse. I'm a Pacific Northwest homebody. You know, I love Vancouver, Washington, Portland, Oregon. You know, my limit being away from home is usually just like a week. So, so we make a lot of sacrifices out here, and I know I'm doing everything I can to get better at my sport. And so all these people chiming in can just watch, watch.
I was in Seattle a couple weeks ago, and I was just amazed that it did not rain one day while I was there. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it's definitely starting to get cold, but yeah, it's been nice. There's been some sun, but it's just cold. So it is nice to be out here in this 80, 90 degree weather right now.
Yeah, here in Florida, I think when I was driving to the office today, I think it was like 72. So yeah, it's that beautiful weather I love here in Florida. Well, we talk about like when you're in Hawaii, what is the average day like for you? Is it just literally you're in the gym 12 hours a day?
Well, no. We'll work out first thing in the morning. Tyson and I will get some kind of drilling, some mitt work. That's what's nice about you know, staying with someone who's also so committed. We get that first workout done pretty early, and that gives us some time, some lag time in between, because pro practices at Hawaii Elite are in the evening. So if we don't have any conditioning or anything like that, we'll go to the beach, we'll go on a hike, we'll go enjoy the sun. You know, we're in Hawaii, we have to. So And then at 7, we put in work. Tyson also trains people over here at the UFC gym. So we'll be in the UFC gym most of the day too. So even if we're not training, we're still basically in the gym, you know?
And of course, this fight goes down here on December the 7th, UFC Fight Night in Washington, D.C. We're going to see Ricky's fight against Rob. Ricky, man, as always, I appreciate the time. Of course, let me know anything you find on social media. And of course, anybody else you want to shout out, man?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ricky Simone UFC. I'm trying to get them Twitter followers up. I'm trying to be a little more active on there. So follow me. And I would like to thank Ball Wash, Northwest Therapeutics, Riverside Payments. This Feed Me, Fight Me is my favorite tea right here. Thank you guys.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report, man, stuff's back inside the UFC Octagon, UFC DC, December the 7th. This takes on Yadong Song. It is Cody Stamen. Cody, man, I appreciate time. How would you describe 2019 for you?
Oh, 2019 has been an absolute roller coaster ride. I mean, so I took a short notice fight against Alejandro Perez, guy that hadn't lost in forever. It's a pretty risky fight, especially taking it on 3 weeks' notice. Went out and beat him. I was on a roll, on a bit of a high. Moving forward, I go to Colorado. I'm training in Colorado, preparing for Rob Font. I have a shoulder injury, sets me back a couple months. A little bit of a re-injury, sets me back about another month. I make the decision to move to Las Vegas. I, in 2 weeks, pack my entire life up and move to Las Vegas to utilize the UFC Performance Institute and some of the coaches out here. I've been here for 4 months now, and what a great move. It's been an absolute game-changing experience for me as far as, being an athlete. 2019 for me, I mean, on paper, you'd say I've only fought once, as a fighter, but I've gotten so much better. So many things have changed. I've learned so much. I think that 2019 has been an awesome year for me.
I've talked to so many fighters who've gone out to the PI, whether they've, like yourself, have said, I'm move to Vegas. I'm going to utilize this year round. Or fighters say, they go there, a couple times a year, and they talk about, it's just some of the tests they put you through of how to maximize your performance. When you started going there and they started really working with you, was there something they said to you that you just kind of had this moment of like, man, I wish I would have known this a year, 2 years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the things they provide are absolutely everything you need outside of the actual training for the sport of MMA. So, I mean, they take away everything. I mean, your nutrition, you have, really, really elite, great people working with you to get your weight where it needs to be. And obviously, I'm a big bantamweight. So, that's been a lifesaver for me. And then PT, I got Dr. Tara Heather working on me, Bobby. I mean, they really, really care about the athletes. They understand what we do. It's hard. There's a lot of really great PTs out there, but not a lot of them understand exactly what an MMA fighter does. And these people do. And then from a strength conditioning standpoint, I've been working with Kyle, and he's absolutely top notch. I mean, they have the absolute best resources, and it's all in one place, So in Michigan, I had to bounce here, bounce there, bounce everywhere. And now I literally go to the PI, or I go to a gym to work with a coach. It's simplified everything. It's kind of held me accountable for my weight and other things. I'm doing the rehab, because there I have to. I'm doing all the things that I need to take care of my body, for longevity. I'm eating better, just all around. I mean, I feel like this experience at the Performance Institute has absolutely changed me as an athlete.
I was watching an interview with James Lynch, and you mentioned about how they had held you accountable on the nutrition aspect.
I'm a fat kid. You have to.
Is it one of those things where, like, it's just like, even like now in training, you can truly feel the difference of kind of being more accountable?
Yeah. Well, one, my weight is I'm probably 5 pounds lighter than I would normally be at this point. 5 pounds doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're talking about someone that's 4% body fat, that is a significant amount, So I took a little bit of muscle off my frame, but I feel, and then all my testing, I'm the biggest, strongest I've ever been. you know, obviously they have a baseline testing when you get there, and my test now, I mean, I'm setting records in the UFC. I gotta think that I'm probably the most athletic, strongest guy at 135 pounds, but I'm also setting, you know, pound for pound weight, records in the UFC for some of the testing. So, you could say that I'm feeling really, really good about, you know, where I am as an athlete, and everything that I've gotten from the USC Performance Institute, because it, you know, it is an elite facility. You know, you have, guys like me in there, and then you have guys that play in the NBA, guys that, play in the NFL, all these other elite athletes that also utilize this facility. So, it's the best. I mean, there's nothing else like it.
When you see an athlete from another sport roll into the PI, do you try to, you know, have a little conversation, kind of pick their brain about how they get ready for their particular sport, and maybe see, is there something they do that you can incorporate it into how you prepare for a fight?
Yeah. I mean, that's one of my, you know, the main things I do is I study the greats. I study the best. I want to know what other guys do that are really good, you know, in their craft. And I've researched, you know, some of the greatest athletes, you know, around the board, and they do everything. I mean, there's no secret to what these guys are doing. You know, they do the mental stuff, they do the physical stuff, they do the rehab, they take care of their body. They do everything. They eat well, they just do everything. They live like an athlete 365 days a year. And that's really the difference between, you know, a guy that makes it in the sport of MMA or the sport of, football, anything. You have to do everything that you can possibly to be your absolute best all the time. I mean, there's no secret, there's no shortcuts. It's discipline. It's hard work day in and day out. And then, you know, it's finding the time to, you know, sit down and do the mental stuff and really, really kind of reinforce that, you know, that belief system that you have in yourself. And, you know, being in Vegas, I've had a lot more time to do that because I don't know anyone here. You know, it's me and it's my girlfriend and my dog. And so it's, I guess you, a lot of people would think that would be lonely, but for me, it's been awesome. You know, it's been awesome because I've had the time to kind of reflect on what I do well, what I don't do well, how I need to break things down and how I need to get better.
So was your girlfriend on board right from the start when you said, "Hey, I'm packing my things up and I got to do this for my career," or is she kind of skeptical?
I think she knew before I did. She was kind of the one that put the bug in my ear a little bit. She was like, "Listen, you know, I have a really good relationship with one of the physical therapists at the PI, Tara. She's also from Michigan. So, you know, we hit it off right away. And, you know, she worked on me and I felt significantly better and with working with her for a week. And then I went home and I wasn't feeling that great. And, you know, we were kind of sitting there like, you know, there's a window and it's always closing when you're an athlete. You know, you're constantly, the clock's ticking. You only have so much time, so many workouts that you can do. So I look at it like, I would rather move to Las Vegas and gain a year in my career because I can stay healthy. You know, because after losing that Rob Font fight, you know, I invested a lot of time and a lot of money in preparing for that fight. And then not to get the reward at the end, I was like, something's got to change. This can't happen again. I'm not going to let this happen again. I need to do everything in my power to make sure that, you know, when I sign a contract, I'm there on fight night. I don't ever want to be in that situation again. You know, 40 fights, 20 amateur, 20 professional fights. That's the first time I've ever had to do that. And I'm hoping it's going to be the last.
I know in our interviews you mentioned about your opponent and that right hand that, you know what's going to come. You're like, look, I've seen it, you know, but is there anything else about his game that has stuck out to you of like things that, you know, are going to happen in the fight?
The kid's, I mean, he's good. He's got really good hands. He's a stud. I mean, there's no question. But who isn't a stud at this level? I mean, name one guy in the top 15 that can't knock you out, choke you out, or, you know, beat you in onto another planet. You know, everyone in the top 15 at bantamweight is really, really good. I'm amongst those people. And that's something, you know, I remind myself every day. It's like, yeah, these guys are awesome. But, you know, I beat guys like this. And honestly, I don't really see anyone 1 to 15 beating me when I'm on my best. When I'm my absolute best, I don't think there's a guy on the planet that can beat me. And that's what I remind myself every day. I'm like, I work just as hard as these guys. I make the sacrifices. I do all the things right. There's absolutely no reason why I can't be the best guy in the world other than, you know, time. I just need time. I need time. I need the fights. That's it. You know, so as much as, you know, I'm focused on Song Yadong and building a game plan to beat him, you know, I'm constantly reminding myself that, you know, I'm the best in the world and I just need the opportunity to prove it. You know, I fought, you know, number two, Aljamain Sterling, probably the next guy to get a title shot. And after that fight, that wasn't a feeling of, man, I just got beat by someone that's better than me. That was, well, I just let myself down. Like, I can beat that guy. I know I can beat that guy. So as much as that fight hurt me, I think it helped me in the way that I realized, all right, you know, the absolute best guys in the world, they're not different than me. Maybe they just have a better night. Maybe they just have a little more experience. And, you know, I need to go out and make sure that I'm going to have those good nights on fight night. And, you know, I need the experience.
Is there any correlation with this fight to your fight against Tom Dukinwall, where, you know, he was seen as a hot prospect and everyone was so high on him? And I think you could say that about your opponent too. Do you see some comparisons between the two fights?
The same. It's the same for me. It's all the same. Even like, in interviews, I feel like it's similar. Everyone's kind of like, you know, did you decide to take this fight or did the UFC decide to take this fight? I mean, like, how did this come about? You can kind of tell people are like, you know, why are you fighting this guy? He's the next best thing coming up. And I kind of got the same thing when I fought Dukinwall. It was like, this is your second fight and you're fighting, you know, Tom Dukinwall. He's the greatest thing since sliced bread. And he's this French kid and he's unstoppable and all this stuff. Even the commentary during the fight. I don't care. You know, I don't care. I don't care about his hype. I don't care where he trains. I don't care where he's from. I don't care who's beat. I don't care what he's done. You know, I went out and gave Tom a lot of respect in that fight because people told me he was great. And then I got in the cage with him and I'm like, he's not any better than anyone I've ever fought. You know, I can beat him. This is like after the first round, I sat down on the stool and I'm like, what am I doing? You know what I mean? Like, I can whoop this kid. What am I doing? I can beat him on my feet. I can beat him on the ground. I can take him down, do whatever the hell I want to him. And, you know, I've had moments like that throughout my career. When I fought Brian Caraway, I'm like, oh, this guy's in the top 10. Oh my God, how am I going to compete with him? You know, he was in the UFC when I was born, you know, so how am I going to beat him? And then after the first round, I'm like, he's just a man, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm to that point where there's no one on the planet that scares me. You know, I've done the hard work. I've done everything to be good at this sport. So, you know, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Song Yadong is a great prospect. And, you know, I think one of the best guys coming out of China, but that doesn't mean shit. I'm going to go out and whoop his ass either way.
I know you likely don't care about the betting odds. You could care less, most likely. But I just, as you're talking, so I just pull them up. So it has Song Yadong as almost a 2-1 betting favorite.
Exactly the same as Tom Dukinwall. Exactly the same. 2-1 favorite. Dukinwall was a 2-1 favorite against me.
Is it motivation? Like, or you just tell you, or you tell your buddies, hey guys, I got some good odds on me.
I think the guys that know me know. The motivation, I don't know. I think it kind of it honestly it irritates me. It pisses me off. Maybe it feels like I'm not getting the respect I deserve. That just means I got to go out and I got to make a statement, right? That's the only thing I can do. I can't change the betting odds or what anyone thinks about this. I just got to go out and do what I know to do and get another win.
Final thing, you mentioned about the move from Michigan to Vegas. I'm guessing you probably don't miss the cold weather.
No, not missing the cold weather. Actually, I got a jacket on right now because I woke up and it was 45 degrees here, but 45 degrees here still isn't snowing and rainy and freezing in Michigan. But I'm going home for the holidays this weekend, so I'll be dressing real warm.
Can you enjoy Thanksgiving meals?
No. Absolutely not. I can't have anything. I'm on a pretty strict diet. I'm pretty much eating, you know, 5 servings of vegetables and 1 serving of protein a day. It's not a great time to be me in the kitchen.
But hey, those are the sacrifices you got to make as your fight is coming up here December the 7th, UFC on ESPN in Washington, D.C. Cody, man, as always, appreciate time. Of course, let me know. You can follow you on social media if there's anybody else you want to shout out.
Everything's just Cody Stamen. Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time and put your money on Cody Stamen. 7-7.
And there was my conversations with Ricky Simon and Cody Stamann. I appreciate both those fighters coming on this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast, talking about their fights coming up next week at UFC DC. Also, do want to mention coming up this week on the MMAReport.com, you're going to see my conversations with the brand new LFA flyweight champion, Brandon Royval. Of course, he got a 23-second submission win last week over Nate Williams. Also, you will be able to see my conversation with Yusuf Zalal, who scored a flying knee knockout that, if you have not seen that from LFA 79, be sure to go that. Just a devastating knee knockout that he had. Also, talk to Modestus Moukakis, who is coming off a successful title defense at Cage Warriors 111, a brutal elbows to the head, very reminiscent of those elbows that Travis Brown had back in the day, getting a knockout victory. So look for that here this week on the MMAReport.com. But I want to finish off this week's edition of the podcast by talking about a tweet I saw this morning. I was kind of just scrolling through my timeline. You know, one of the things I do here on Wednesday morning, you know, I do a lot of my podcast prep on Mondays and Tuesdays, but, you know, Wednesday morning, because we do this show in the morning, you know, before I head to the studio, I'm going through my timeline and kind of seeing if there's anything that happened overnight. And I saw a tweet from Chris Cyborg where she had quoted a tweet from Amy Kaplan. If you're not familiar with Amy Kaplan, she's a she works for Fansided MMA. She's an editor over there, also a very good photojournalist. And she had tweeted yesterday, she said, "I might finally get my dad to an MMA fight. He wants to see Chris Cyborg." And I thought Chris's tweet was very interesting, where she quoted a tweet and she said, quote, "This is how women change the sport of MMA. When men go to fights, it often is a guy's night out. But when women go to the fights, they bring their dad, daughter, son, husband, grandparents. They make it a family event, which changed the way people look at the sport of MMA." And Daniel, I would say that I see where Chris Cyborg is going there, because, you know, for a lot of families, the wife may make the financial decision. They may make that decision of, you know, where are we going to go on a Saturday night? Now, personally, for me, when I go out to a fight, and I mentioned, like, you know, these days, I don't really necessarily, you know, sit there and want to go cover an event. You know, I like to go with the fellas, you know, have a couple of beers, you know, and sit there and enjoy the fights, just have a good night with the fellas. But I understand what Chris Cyborg is saying there. And, you know, the way I would kind of reword what she said is basically is, hey, if we're going to take mixed martial arts to the next level, we've got to get women coming out to the fights.
Yeah, man. At the end of the day, if you want to take this sport to the next level, it's got to be a part of culture, and it's got to be like a big time fight. Look at how many people were paying attention to the Deontay Wilder fight this weekend. It was men, it was women, it was people of all ages. It was a big time fight. It was a cool deal. And you want to transcend more than just a bros night out if you're a sport. And for MMA, I mean, that has to be the goal. And for Ronda Rousey, I mean, she got there. Cyborg didn't really get there, except for the Carano fight was a big one. And she's had a couple of big fights. But Ronda Rousey, I mean, she brought people of all ages and genders to the table. And that is something where, you know, it's paramount. And it just lets you know that you've made it as a sport.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's, you know, Chris Cyborg, I think, inside the MMA community is a well-known name, but, you know, it's like I say, if I always use the analogy, you walk into a sports bar, like tonight, Thanksgiving is a huge night in the bar business. You walk into pretty much any bar tonight, it's going to be a packed house. You know, if I go in there and you have a photo alignment and you say, pick out Chris Cyborg, how many people can do it? I don't know. But if you had a lineup of Ronda Rousey, probably 10 out of 10 people. Do you put Gina Carano? I would think a majority of people would. It may be 8, 9, or 10, and particularly because of her acting. You know, I mean, look, she's a, you know, without Gina Carano, is Ronda Rousey who she is? Probably, but Gina played a huge role in that.
Yeah, I mean, Gina played a huge role in creating that opportunity for Ronda Rousey to use Strikeforce as a launching pad into the UFC, for sure. I mean, from Elite XC to Strikeforce, the Gina Carano fights were big-time deals. And I don't know if there was another female fighter that would have had that level of success with that level of charisma. And, you know, Gina was marketed incredibly well. And she is absolutely one of the foundational pieces of why women's mixed martial arts is just, it's just another weight class in the UFC, which is perfect. That's what it needs to be. Just another weight class. It's normal. But you go back to UFC 91, the idea of where we are today would have seemed insane.
Yeah, we also, we should mention here before we get out of here, the main event for the UFC pay-per-view coming up on February 8th in Houston, Texas is set. It's Jon Jones versus Dom Reyes, so kind of that light heavyweight picture now, you know, coming into play. You know, it makes me wonder if that card, maybe we'll see Cody Anderson on that card. Maybe it is against Jan Blachowicz, and they go with a rematch there. Also, Valentina is going to defend her title in the co-main event against Caitlin. God, Valentina is going to be a huge favorite in that one.
Yeah, she's going to be a huge.
The question is does it reach 10-1?
It's certainly possible. Honestly, I don't think so.
But I bet it opens like 6-1. I bet you.
Yeah, it's going to be a big odds.
But, yeah, I mean, I'm just looking. So odds are out for Jon Jones, Dom Reyes, Bovada, William Hill, Bet Online have odds out there. Yeah, any guesses how big favorite Jon Jones is?
I'm going to say 320.
Wrong. 4-1 there, boss.
4-1?
Wow. So at Bovada, he is minus 400. William Hill, he is minus 455. And at Bet Online, wow, he's minus 450.
Wow. Yeah, man. Jon Jones, he's a big favorite.
Look, I expect Jon Jones to win that fight. But I think stylistically, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see with the length that Dom Reyes does have of how that can go. I mean, in terms of, you know, realistic fights that can be made, you know, Jones, Dom Reyes is probably the fight that interests me the most with Jon Jones. I mean, I guess, you know, Jones and Israel Adesanya are going to keep going at it with each other on social media. But, you know, I mean, I guess that's a fight we could see at some point, but I feel it's more likely we see Jon Jones against a heavyweight before we see Jon Jones versus Israel Adesanya.
Yeah, I think it's a great fight, but it's definitely a fight where Jon Jones deserves to be the heavy favorite. But look, all the time we see the all-time greats, they drop a fight. They lose a fight when we don't expect it. And the longer you fight close to the sun, the more you get burnt. And you never know when a fighter, an all-time great fighter, is going to get burnt out and just look listless and let the challenger become victorious.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to kind of see what happens there, but that'll be February 8th. I want to say, is that, I'm not sure if that's Super Bowl weekend or the weekend after the Super Bowl. I want to say that's the weekend after the Super Bowl.
It's the Super Bowl 2020 is February 2nd. So yeah.
Yeah. We have Super Bowl. Yeah. So yeah, man, February will be here before you know it, Daniel. I mean, it's already, you know, Christmas time, and I'm not a Black Friday shopper. Good luck with that, by the way. Don't get run over.
I will try my best not to, buddy.
Are they sending you out at like 5 o'clock in the morning?
No.
Oh, see, that one. Yeah, I'll never forget. So when I was doing marketing for a radio station, one year I had to be at Walmart at like 4 a.m. That was interesting. Yeah. I had never really done the Black Friday shopping, but to see basically like, you know, literally when you have cops sitting outside, just basically trying to make sure nothing goes wrong. That's like, and then there were still people arguing.
Yeah. There's literally police. Like, how are you doing that? Yeah.
I'm more of the Cyber Monday shopper.
Yeah.
That's more my style.
Chilling in a bathrobe on your computer.
Okay, I love me some online shopping. Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's just, you know, that's not, maybe there'll be a Cyber Monday deal like on UFC Fight Pass or DAZN for people out there. That'd be cool for people. But I don't see DAZN really doing that.
No, I don't think they can afford to
yeah, do a deal yeah, like that. I think they just need subscribers to pay that $20 a month. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that is going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast. Of course, I appreciate everyone tuning in to listen to the show. Of course, be sure to check out our advertiser, Roman. Just go to GetRoman.com/MMA Report to get a free online visit and free due 2-day shipping. Of course, this podcast is available on RadioInfluence.com, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and Google Podcasts. Of course, new episodes come out every Wednesday. Of course, myself and Daniel will be back next Wednesday. Actually, we'll have a UFC fight card to preview. We haven't had a chance to do that in the last 2 weeks, but we'll have that coming up next week on the podcast. Let's go wrap up for this week's edition of the AmeriPort Podcast, which comes out every Wednesday on RadioInfluence.com.
I'm Jerry P. Tuck, CEO of Radio Influence. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on this program, or you have some show ideas that you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you took time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means a lot. Without you, the listeners, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to this show. Don't forget to check out RadioInfluence.com to see what other shows we also have to offer. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, RadioInfluence.com.